The world of the self. So what we've been doing is, I think it's fair to say we started with the idea that you know, we started with the program, the plan of looking at our ordinary understanding of time, and we looked at the present, the polar knowledge aspect of it, and we looked at the past, the descriptive knowledge aspect of it, and that led us. And I was actually trying to remember before all this got in the way, all this technical stuff, that led us to the issue about models and interpretations. What I was trying to remember was how we got from the analysis of time to models and interpretations. Can anybody help me there? How that connection got made? Either I just lost everybody or nobody can help me. Okay. Between the analysis of time and the analysis of how knowledge gets constructed, made out of interpretations and models and constructs and so on. There was some kind of a bridge between the two.
I don't know. It seems that our understanding of time is a model.
Well, that is definitely true, and that may be that that may be one reason.
We started looking at the moment, and then we started going back into memory.
Yeah, you're right. I'm looking at it now here, and that is basically how it moved. You're right.
We deconstructed the validity of prevailing constructs.
Thank you very much. That's how, that's true. I think that what Tina pointed out about memory is the bridge, though. The idea is that when we look at reality and we say, okay, well, everybody knows what's real. It's what's going on around us in the world. And we say, well, wait a minute, how do you know that? And it turns out that the answer is descriptive knowledge. That is, there's a world that we've described, and so we kind of open our eyes in the morning when we wake up and we enter this world that is already there waiting for us. But the reason it's waiting for us is because we've described it to ourselves. We've named it, we've labeled it. And once we realize, or once we're willing to entertain the idea that reality really is something that we construct through describing it to ourselves, and of course other people, you know, when we're babies, other people are the ones who are describing the world to us, and gradually we just buy into their description. So it's not this wonderful, this amazing act of creation by just me. It's a kind of a joint act of creation. But once we buy into the idea or entertain the notion that the world that we inhabit is constructed out of our descriptions, then that leads us to ask the question, isn't there something more substantial than just our descriptions? Aren't the descriptions, if you say, well, the descriptions are labels that we apply, then that model suggests that there's something that we put the label on, right? We there's some underlying reality and we label it. And even if that reality, before we label it, is just this big undifferentiated mass, like a big cloud kind of, and gradually as we label it, it takes on form, even so you'd say, yeah, but at least there's that underlying reality. So we wind up looking at that question. And what we've been exploring is the idea that really there isn't anything. Even if you say, well, there's some undifferentiated cloud, before we label things, well, that's also a label, right? The one before all the labels. That label, the thing.
What got me was the reality underneath the reality of descriptive knowledge is only an interpretation.
That's right. We're you know, and the point that he's making is that we are, you know, even the interpretation that it's only an interpretation is an interpretation. I mean, you can't stop. You know, once you're on that that slippery slope, as we used to say when I was in law school, you know, once you recognize that reality is something that emerges out of our descriptions, our labels, our models, our constructs, and our interpretations, those are all the words that Rinpoche has been using, then there's no place where you can draw a line, because it's interpretations all the way down. So that somehow seems unsatisfying. I mean, it, you know, conceptually you might say, cool, you know, I understand that. And you might even say, I recognize that that gives me a lot of freedom, because if it all comes out of my interpretations and labels, then in theory I've got the possibility of relabeling. You know, I could do it differently, and I could find myself living in a very different world. Now, doing that in practice may be more difficult, but you could say that. But when you say that, when you say, okay, I accept the notion that it's all interpretations, that's a conceptual acceptance, you know, or that's an interpretation. I guess that's another way of saying it. You haven't necessarily gotten very far. So we're starting over in a sense. And what Rinpoche said, not in this chapter, but in the previous chapter, was that if you start over and you say, well, there must be something more real than that, even if I can't point to it or label it, because the moment I point to it or label it, I'm back in the same boat. I've got the same problem. There must be something more real. And you say, well, what is it? And what Rinpoche says, and I think this is really an interesting move, because people sometimes say, you know, TSK is so conceptual. But here he makes a move which actually suggests just the opposite. He says, no, what makes us think that there's something real is just the feeling. Just the feeling that there's something real. There is a difference, right? If we imagine something, that's different from being there. I'm seeing a few little technical notes here, but I'll leave that to the people who are trying to make it work, and I hope they can make it work. So there is a difference between what we imagine and what we accept as being real. And that difference is just the feeling of something being real. And so there was that example in the reading for last week, which I suggested as an exercise for this week, between, you know, looking at the cup on the table in front of you, or looking at your computer or your phone or whatever it is, and then closing your eyes and imagining it. And the exercise is just to say, well, what's the difference between those two? That difference, that feeling of something being real, that's what we rely on, and that's the witness. Now let me ask you whether anybody did that exercise. Anybody experimented with that, whether as a formal exercise or not, during the week?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, you want to say something about your experience?
Yeah, it seems to me that reality seems to be state specific. That if I'm dreaming, and I'm in the dream, that seems real. If I'm awake and having an experience, that seems real. So it seems that the sense of reality is state-specific. I'm a psychologist, and I work with people who have all kinds of experiences in particular states of mind, and those experiences seem real when they're in that state of mind, but when they're in a different state of mind, it doesn't seem real.
Okay, I think that's a very good point, and I just had a kind of a vivid dream this morning. It's one of those paralysis dreams, you know, where there's that, because when you're asleep, you're basically paralyzed. And I was just trying to take off a jacket, and I couldn't do it. It was just stuck to me. It was very frustrating. And that felt very real. You're right, because it was in a dream. And I'm sure you get that with your clients. Anybody else want to say something about their experience with that, or any conclusions they draw from trying to explore that feeling of the real?
Well, go ahead. Something unreal that feels unreal, the feel of unreal as real as the feel of real. So there seems to be still a difference between the feel of real and the feel of unreal.
Well, that's interesting. So you're saying that, if, for instance, if you imagine something, if you close your eyes and imagine something, that has its own feeling, and that feeling is just as real? Is that what you're saying?
No, no. I have had experiences. Reality wouldn't come into being, you know? It was a very clear sense of this is not real. And that sense was very real. I don't know how I can describe it.
Okay, so there's, you know that, I think I may have mentioned this in here or somewhere recently, but there was a movie back, I think, in the 1960s called Rosemary's Baby. Sort of I don't know how many of you remember that, but it was a kind of a horror movie in which this woman sleeps with the devil. Her husband has kind of made a deal with the devil, and she sleeps with the devil because the devil wants to have a human baby, basically. And at a certain point in that sequence that's being shown in the film, she opens her eyes and she says, this is not a dream. That relates to me, it seems to me that relates to both what Hayward said and to what Yolaine said. We carry around a certain feeling of real, and the feeling of unreal, well, I'm not sure that I'm really understanding what you're saying, Yolaine. I mean, what I want to say is the feeling of unreal can be just as real in its own way as the feeling of real. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. So, anybody else? So there were several people who were going to speak up.
I tried a couple of those exercises of the four you listed in your notes.
Right.
The first one was kind of, the difference could be adequately explained to myself in that when you're trying to visualize something, your initial intention is to repeat or to recall something, so it's different than kind of like the surprising, spontaneously arising nature of experience. And so it wasn't so much real or unreal, just that it was a deliberate exercise from the beginning. The second one was more interesting to me. It was like trying to stay with the sensation rather than ascribing some content to it. That turned out sort of interesting to me, and it was like being in a realm where something surprising could come up, something not so pre-identified. And so I found that was sort of interesting. It sort of drew attention to the fact that most of my experiences and ascribing of images, projecting of images, I found that interesting.
Yeah. Okay, well, you know, I think this is interesting, and I hope in a way that encourages people to continue with that kind of exploration, because as I said before, you can accept conceptually that we are dependent on our interpretations. But what we really want to get a sense of is that even the thing that we rely on the most, which Rinpoche describes in the previous chapter as the witness, even that is an interpretation. But in order to understand that, you have to reinterpret interpretation. Or, you know, reconceptualize concepts or have a different model of what it means to have a model. To the point where really those whole notions of model and interpretation and concept are going to be transformed kind of out of themselves. So what I really want to talk about now is I want to bring that into this chapter. Because what happens in this chapter is there is a move. We talk about the witness, we talk about that feeling, and we want to explore what the feeling of reality is. What is it? There isn't any other basis for reality. That's basically what's being said. It's you know, we can't just say in the way that somebody on the street would say, well, the real is the real, you know, and you hit your hand on the table and say, see, it's real. We can't just say that because we understand conceptually that that won't work. But there is still the feeling, the feel of the real. You hit your hand on the table and it feels real in a way that it wouldn't if you imagine hitting your hand on the table. If you were really, really good at imagining or visualizing, you might kind of get close. But that would be a whole different move. That would be like what Hayward said. You could kind of maybe create a different world. But you would still, what you'd be doing would be moving toward that feel of the real as the guarantor of reality. So in this chapter, what Rinpoche is doing, or what he's saying, is when you try to understand that feel of the real, the witness to reality, when you try to make sense out of that, you immediately, absolutely, are involved with the sense of the self. Because, and Rinpoche doesn't say this, but I'm going to say it, because what feels the most real, what feels the most undeniable to us, is our own self. And this chapter begins to explore what that's like. So I think what I want to do is have us do a little exercise here on the phone. We're going to run late this morning because it took us so long to get going because of the technical part. So what I want to do, if you guys are okay with it, is just have us do this exercise and do it from the negative side. You know, and what I mean by the negative side is, here you are, you're listening, we're talking, it's Sunday, you're in wherever you are. And in all of that, there is a sense that the experience you're having is your experience, right? I mean, each of you can say, I think without, I'm pretty sure this is true for everybody, each of you can say, I'm the one who's having this experience, or this is my experience. Or William James gives an interesting example. He says, if Paul and John are both sleeping in the same bed at night, and one of them has a dream, Paul has a dream, when he wakes up, he has absolutely no doubt that it was his dream, not John's dream. And that sense of, it's my experience, it's my memory, it's my plan, or whatever it is, that is the way the self manifests. So the exercise I'd like us to do, and just do it for a couple of minutes, is to see if you can question that. I'm not saying that you'll be able to necessarily, but see what it's like to let your experience be your experience, but try to strip away the sense that it's my experience. Was that clear?
Yes.
Okay, let's try that. Okay, a couple of minutes. Okay, let's stop there. So I'm interested in reactions, and let me just try to point your reactions or your discussion in a certain way. The question that seems to me the most interesting was, how did you try to do that? You know, what was the step that you took? But if you want to talk about what you found when you tried to do it, that's okay too. But who would like to say something?
This is Cecilia. The sense that I'm not sure I took it; it just happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I took it.
But, okay. Good point.
Was that the scalp and ears and throat all relaxed for a moment, and it seemed like there was a bigger space to breathe into.
Okay, that's interesting. So it went in the direction of space, and your sense was that it was less your experience when it was more spacious. Is that?
Yes, just for a moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody else want to say something?
I had a similar experience. I breathed into the both the construct of myself having the experience and breathed into the sensation of self and tried to, I kind of had this opening or dissolving or relaxing of that tendency with the breath.
Okay. So there's a relaxing tendency or quality, and I know, Hayward, you work with the breath quite a bit, so that was natural for you to go in that direction. But, okay. Somebody else wanted to say something?
Yeah, Ari. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi. So what I noticed was the only way that I could not have myself is I didn't interpret. I tried not to interpret my experiences, which is really difficult. Because every time, you know, we're having an experience, an interpreter is always there. So I kind of relaxed and went into meditative mode, and that helped.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've got this theme of relaxation. I think that's fair to say. Anybody else?
Well, I noticed that it not only did it open up, but I went deeper into myself also.
Mm-hmm. So what can you say more what you have in mind when you say deeper into yourself?
Well, everything everybody else said about the relaxation, but there was a sense of It was my experience, but it was not only my experience. And so that opened up, and it felt deeply to be my experience, but it also opened up to where, it was all of our experiences.
Mm-hmm.
It was really nice. It was a nice feeling.
Okay, good. Well, I noticed there was one point, there were certain sounds that were coming in through the telephone, while we were doing the exercise, and there was one very brief moment when somebody spoke. It seemed to be in the background, and actually in that moment I realized there was a difference, because that was somebody else's experience. You know, somebody else was speaking, and it reminded me that they were having an experience, and so it wasn't so much my experience. But of course, what I wasn't paying attention to was that I was the one hearing the person speak, but it still kind of threw me outside myself a little bit. Okay. Well, I think this theme of relaxation is actually really interesting and important, and it seems to be natural when people do it. If you look at the first paragraph of the chapter, where Rinpoche talks about how the self sets up a world, he says that it's the self establishes itself and the world. And then he says how the self does that. And he says, it takes a position, it posits a situation, and it imposes meaning. And I've always loved that sentence, partly because of the way it plays on the root word of meaning to put, you know, the posing, the positing, the position. Those are all related to each other. But for our purpose right now, I think maybe the key point is the notion that the self has to impose meaning. Now, you could go back to the same question we asked before. What does it impose it on? And there may not be an answer to that. You know, the way our language works, we kind of make that distinction. You know, there has to be some underlying ground, and that may not at all be the case. But what he is pointing to here is that there's a kind of an act of will, you could say, or a kind of a forcefulness. You know, the self is busy making meaning. The self is busy setting up a world. The self has this job to do. And part of what that means is that there is an underlying tension involved in our experience. That's just the nature of our experience, that we can't just relax and let the experience be what it is. The self is the one that is going to establish a world. And that's not, you know, that's not free. Right? In other words, you don't do that just by kind of wishing it, although in a sense you could say that. The self does that by actively structuring, by actively imposing, by actively creating this world. And for reasons we haven't really gone into, but I think you all seem to have the sense of this, that's a job that involves a lot of tension. I think what we could say is that it's, in a way, it's not a natural thing. You know, the self is busy making something happen that wouldn't happen if there was no self to make it happen. And so if you can relax that tension, and that's what people were talking about, then the sense of self becomes less strong. Now, a question we could ask is, suppose you could really relax that more and more so that we didn't have such a strong sense of the self at the center of our experience. Does that mean that the whole notion of something being real would disappear? And I think you have to look at that question in a couple of different ways. Insofar as it's related to a certain tension and a certain sense of things have to be this way, I think the answer may be yes. But if there's a concern there, and I could imagine that there would be a concern, if the concern is that we don't, you know, if reality disappears, or if the self is the one who establishes reality, isn't doing its job anymore, then we're just left in a complete void, in complete nothingness. That's not the case. Or at least, you know, I think it's very clear from everything in the time-space knowledge vision that that's not the case. But it may be that in the beginning you have to kind of explore and see, well, why wouldn't it be the case? Or you may find yourself worrying about that. And so you need to develop a little confidence, I guess you could say, in your own experience when it stops being your own. Now, our language and our way of thinking about all these things is set up so that, you know, we inevitably wind up talking about my experience or my understanding, or here's how it seemed to me, or here's what I did to make a change. The self is so thoroughly embedded in our language structure and our way of thinking that it's very difficult to challenge it at that level. But, you know, we don't necessarily have to challenge it on the level of language, because that's just language. The place that we're talking about challenging it right now is on this level of feeling. So what Rinpoche talks about in this chapter is that the characteristic of the self is that it exists across time. And if we want to continue to explore this possibility that we could have experience without the self is the owner of that experience, we need to look more carefully at this whole notion of time. So I don't think we can do any more today, but you know, there's this remarkable sentence at the end of page 149 where Rinpoche writes that the self really, through its desires, through its wanting to exist, through its wanting to establish a world, through its wanting there to be something substantial and solid, that the self is really responsible for creating what he calls the momentum of linear time, the whole notion of a past unfolding into a present, unfolding into a future, that really is the outcome of what the self does, a self-propelled acceleration. I think that's a really interesting place to look. So we're at a place now where I think it's really possible to explore this material experientially. And I want to encourage you to do that. One possibility would be to try the exercise that goes with this chapter, exercise 18, which is called Projecting the Future. And the structure of that is a little complicated, but look through it and see if you might want to, how would you go about doing it? If you do it, allow yourself a little time to do it. You can also just try this practice that we just did. From time to time during the week, just ask yourself, what is it that makes this experience mine? And what would it be like if it weren't mine? And how could I try to make it not mine? And this clue that people have given us, that relaxation seems really important, continue to work with that. You know, if you go more toward the space side, more toward the feeling side, more toward the flow of feeling and breath, a lot of different ways to do this. So we want to kind of loosen up this tension, which is the hallmark of the self trying to create its world. So let's go with that for in terms of experience and exercises during the next week.